It's the Nahum Segal Network. Welcome to a segment we call By the Book. I want to thank our friends at Curran Publishers and Magid Books for bringing this to you in its first run form every Tuesday at 10 a.m. right here at the Nahum Segal Network, jmandtheam.org and nahumsegal.com. This week we have an amazing guest. We have an opportunity to speak with somebody who is an absolute expert on the topic of which he's written. Rabbi Mordechai Willig is with us. The book is entitled The Laws of Cooking and Warming Food on Shabbat. It is a publication of the Michael Scharf Publication Trust of Yeshiva University Press at REITs. It is part of the REITs Halacha series, the series editor by Daniel Z. Feldman, somebody who has joined us before on the topic of the REITs Halacha series. And as we said, it's a Magid Books release, which is an imprint of Koren Publications. And in just a moment, I will introduce Rabbi Willig to this audience. The Laws of Cooking and Warming Food on Shabbat is a comprehensive presentation of Hilchot Bishul and the reasoning behind the laws. In this wide-ranging volume, Rabbi Mordechai Willig presents and analyzes the opinions of the most respected voices in halachic discourse. He traces the law from the biblical prohibition to rabbinic legislation and from medieval authorities to decisors of our time. Exploring new issues involving present-day applications and the impact of modern technology, the laws of cooking and warming food on Shabbat encompasses the range of complexities and challenges of this central area of Jewish law, is a crucial resource for laymen, students, and scholars alike. The volume is published in cooperation with Yeshiva University Press with supplementary notes and rulings by Rabbi Herschel Schachter. Rabbi Mordechai Willig, our guest this morning, is the Rabbi Dr. Sal Roth, Professor of Talmud and Contemporary Halacha at Yeshiva University's Mazer Yeshiva Program, the Rosh Kollel of the Wexner Kollel Elyon, and the Skan Rosh Kollel at the Kollel Hara at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary and affiliate of Yeshiva University. He's also the Deputy Av Beth Din of the Beth Din of America and author of its prenuptial agreement. Rabbi Willig has served as a spiritual leader of the Young Israel of Riverdale in the Bronx since 1974. He's author of Am Mordechai, a series of Sfarim on the Talmud, and has published many articles in Torah journals. In this case, he's bringing us the laws of cooking and warming food on Shabbat. Rabbi Mordechai Willig, welcome to the Nahum Segal Network.
Thank you, Nahum.
What a pleasure to have you, and great to speak with you today. It's no secret that the topic of cooking on Shabbat is a complicated one. In fact, it's funny, not that this is specifically a Shabbos issue, what I'm about to bring up, but I'll never forget back in the old days when I was in the high school dormitory in Riverdale, I approached somebody who was very well versed in halacha and asked if something could be done, if I could go ahead and do something in one of the ovens that we had in the dormitory. And his response to me was, "Call your mother." Meaning that as well versed as he was, and trust me, he was in the laws, when you're not in it every single day, sometimes you could lose track of things. And sure enough, I know this may come as a shock to you, I am not in the kitchen on a daily basis in the area of cooking and warming food, so I am no expert, but we certainly could use the expertise of someone like yourself. I think where I want to start is essentially where the book begins at some point, and that is discussing the prohibition of cooking and baking on Shabbos. Are those regulations very similar?
Cooking and baking are basically the same thing. The Talmud teaches us that the Mishnah uses the expression of ofer, of baking, because it gives what is called sidura de pas. It goes in an order of the first 11 of the 39 forbidden categories of work are all related to baking. But it's clear that cooking and baking are fundamentally the same.
And when we go ahead and we talk about the complexities of knowing what to cook or how to cook or what not to do on Shabbos, I guess one of the most important things is to realize when you actually are cooking. In other words, one of the most famous things in the halacha category of cooking is knowing when something is partially cooked, or if you've gone ahead and prepared something before Shabbos that now is cooked enough to be regarded as not cooking on Shabbos. Would those guidelines be among the most important when it comes to cooking on Shabbos?
Absolutely. There's a fundamental dispute, which is discussed at the very beginning of the book, as to whether a particular food which was cooked before Shabbos partially, and the halachic term for that is ma'achol ben drusoy. Ben drusoy was a bandit who ran from place to place and couldn't cook his food fully. He cooked it either a half or a third. And if one takes food which had reached that level before Shabbos and cooks it on Shabbos, is that a violation of cooking or not? The Rambam says that it is. The Rashba says that it's not. That's one of the fundamental topics which is discussed in the book. In point of practical halacha, we follow the Rambam. The one may not cook something unless it has been fully cooked from before Shabbos. We have a principle known as Ein Bishul Achar Bishul, perhaps the most famous of all principles, that one cannot cook something which has been previously cooked, even if it's been cooled down in the interim. We're talking about solid foods now.
Right.
There's a novel idea in the book, which that the Rambam himself may not fully agree with that. He may maintain that there is a rabbinical prohibition in the case of what we call bishul achar bishul, but normative halacha accepts the leniency that once something has been fully cooked, you may reheat it from the perspective of cooking, as long as it is dry. You may reheat it on Shabbos, and that is how we accept, in a practical sense, that is the first half of the book. The book divides into two parts. The first part one is about the actual laws of cooking, for which I just gave the actual answer.
Right.
Whereas part two discusses rabbinical ordinances about on what type of fire something is cooked for fear that one may either convey an appearance of cooking or one may adjust the fire. But I'm answering you on the level of part one.
Right.
That once it's fully cooked, there's no further prohibition of cooking with respect to dry food. With respect to liquids, we accept a stricter view, as it's found in the Shulchan Aruch, that we have a principle of yesh bishul achar bishul bedover lach, something which is wet and cools off beyond the point when it can be no longer served as hot food. You have chicken soup. You know, it's not fully hot. It still can pass as somewhat hot. Then we apply the leniency of ein bishul achar bishul. Once it's cooled off beyond that point, one may not reheat it.
So let's jump back for a moment so we can talk about the first practical aspect of all this. If Shabbos is at, I don't know, 4:40 in the afternoon, which would be an appropriate time for this time of year. Let's say it's 4:40 in the afternoon. The first thing everyone has to know is that if they cannot go ahead and put something in their oven at 4:30, especially something that takes a while to cook, that would certainly have no chance of being allowed to be eaten on Shabbos, right?
Not necessarily, Nachum. Let me explain. After 4:40, they can't put anything on a fire which hasn't been fully cooked.
Right.
However, if they put something there before 4:40, even though it continues to cook on Shabbos, from the perspective of the laws of the Lamates Malachas of cooking, it's no different than lighting a fire at 4:30, which goes all Shabbos. In other words, the prohibition of cooking is if you do an action on Shabbos. If you put it there before Shabbos, technically there's no violation of cooking whatsoever, even if it continues to cook after the sun sets on Friday.
All right, so if someone does, in fact, put something in their oven, even something that requires 2 hours of cooking, and it's before sunset, there's some room to suspect. I don't want to go into specifics and say to everybody they can do whatever they want. They should check with their rabbi. But
they should ask their mother.
Right, or ask their mother, correct. But there is room to suspect that they might be on the positive side of being able to eat that food on Shabbos.
Not just that. In some cases, it would be permissible to do it even in the first instance, because you're not in violation of cooking if you did your act before Shabbos. The only issues of part two of the book, of rabbinic ordinances, because of the semblance of cooking or because of a fear that one may justify on Shabbos, those rather complex laws come into play.
All right, so is there an example you can give me of a situation where somebody would do what I described, but it's not recommended, meaning, again, at 4:30 or 10 minutes before sunset, to be more accurate in terms of the halachas of Shabbos, 10 minutes before sunset, put something in the oven, and you would advise, or anybody would advise, it's not a good idea?
Absolutely. If a person puts something in the oven before Shabbos, and it has, let's say, for argument's sake, not reach the level of formal partial cooking, we call machal ben drusoy, then there's a significant fear that an individual may adjust the fire. In the old days, he would stoke the coals.
Right.
Today, he would turn up the gas, which, according to most authorities, is the halachic equivalent. And therefore, one may not put something on an open fire before Shabbos unless it's reached, according to the way Ashkenazim follow, at least the Machol Ben Dusoy level from before Shabbos. If it has not reached that level and the fire is exposed, that is a prohibition which is known in our language as Shehiya, leaving something improperly on the fire from before Shabbos, which is the first topic of part two of the book.
Right. Now, there are two instances that I have come up with where this could be a real practical problem. The first is that often, sometimes right before Shabbos, somebody, the person responsible for preparing food for Shabbos in the home, finds out that there are more guests than they thought. and they have a desire to run and put an extra roast in the oven even minutes before Shabbos. And that would be a practical question, an application of the laws that you're describing. And I think the other situation is, sometimes the people, again, who are in charge of the kosher kitchen, might have a desire to toss it together right before Shabbos when it was not originally on their Shabbos menu. And again, in that case as well, they'd have to make sure they're doing things kahalacha, right?
Absolutely correct. And fortunately, there is a solution to these problems, which is something which we know in our language as a blech,
right,
or a covering of the fire. It's accepted in the halacha that, although there are dissenters, that if the fire is covered, one may put food on that covered fire before Shabbos, even if it has not yet reached the level of partial cooking of Machol Ben Drusoy.
Right.
That would be the way to advise someone in that situation. Put it on a covered fire from before Shabbos and let it cook on Shabbos.
And then when it comes to cholent, we're hoping and assuming that it's there for so many hours that it'll come out just as delicious.
Well, you have to be very careful in such an instance not to touch that pot at all until the food becomes fully cooked, presumably by the next morning. Because what one may be certainly not permitted to do is to, for example, pick up the cover of that pot to see how it's doing and put it down again. Because since it's not fully cooked, when you put down the cover of the pot, you are hastening the cooking process, which is a very serious violation.
And if it would be fully cooked, then you can put it anywhere on the blech you wish?
Well, let's go slow. If it's fully cooked from before Shabbos and you're putting it on the blech, you may put it on any part of the blech. The primary reason for blech in homes in which the food is at least half cooked or sometimes even fully cooked before Shabbos, the primary reason for the blech is to enable one to remove a pot from the fire and to be able to hold on to it and to return it. In the classical case, when there was a kettle on the fire, you wanted to pour a cup of tea, so you would take the kettle off the blech, pour a cup of tea, and put it right back on again. This is something which is known in our language as hachzara, returning. This requires absolutely a covered fire.
Right. All right, Mordechai Willig is with us via telephone. The book is entitled The Laws of Cooking and Warming Food on Shabbat, a Magid Books release, which is an imprint, of course, of Koren Publications. You can go to korenpub.com. It's a partnership with the Michael Scharf Publication Trust of Yeshiva University Press and REITs and the REITs Halacha series, which is edited by Rabbi Daniel Z. Feldman. While we're on the topic of cholent, which I brought up, a lot of people use a crock pot. Now, I had actually indicated in the notes before this interview that we need to speak certainly about some of the modern day inventions, some of the technological advances, and I of course had microwave ovens and things like that in mind. I don't know if a crock pot falls in that category. It may follow halachically the way we would treat an oven. So what would you say in terms of a cholent and a crock pot, any differences compared to what you described with a conventional oven?
That's an excellent question. I will first answer your other point about microwave ovens, because microwave ovens has more to do with part one of the book.
Okay.
Part one of the book describes what is considered halachically cooking. There's a fascinating Talmudic point that one who cooks in the sun has not violated the laws of cooking. And this leads to a question of what is the status of a microwave. There are those who consider a microwave to be cooking in the sun because it's based on waves and not based on any real heat source, whereas others disagree. And they claim that the only time one is exempt when cooking in the sun is when it's an abnormal activity, whereas microwaves today are very normal. That's a fascinating dispute which is analyzed in part one. I just wanted to mention it since you spoke about microwaves.
Sure.
But to go back to your question of crockpots, which belongs to part two of the book of rabbinical ordinances, I have to preface my remarks by saying that in the typical crockpot, we encounter an additional problem, which is something known as hatmana. Hatmana means if something is surrounded by insulation, it may be a violation in and of itself. And this is a famous dispute of 20 years ago, approximately, when crockpots began, whether a violation of hatmana indeed occurs. Some claimed, and this is the psak which is quoted in the name of Rav Moshe Feinstein, that since the top is exposed, it's not a violation of hatmana. And perhaps his famous last psak of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is quoted as saying that it is a violation, since the majority of the internal part of the crockpot is surrounded by the floor and the walls in a fairly tight fit. It may be a violation of hatmana. And in order to overcome that problem, it's been suggested to raise the internal pot of the crockpot off the floor of the crockpot. Some use marbles or some tinfoil balls, whatever it is. This way, if you raise it a little bit, since the internal pot is usually tapered, then it's not going to be touching the sides or the bottom as a result of it being lifted, and the hatmana issue is, in fact, solved in that fashion.
So just to make it clear, this is not an issue of what is being done or not done before Shabbos. This is if it simply is sitting there on Shabbos in the status of hatmana, that is a problem.
Correct. According to Rabbi Shlomo Zalman, it is a problem. So it's a solvable problem in one of two ways. One is, as I said before, to lift it with some...
Right.
The other way, the better way, if you ask me, is instead of buying a crockpot which has high walls on the sides, the same exact result can be achieved with what I'll call a slow cooker, which has the heat source only on the bottom. There are no walls on the sides. And therefore, you have completely solved the problem of hatmana, according to certainly Ashkenazi practice, that hatmana does not apply if it's only touching a hot surface on the bottom. That's issue number one. Issue number two, for which, again, the slow cooker is preferred to the original crock pot, is the question of whether something can be taken out of a crock pot and returned back into the crock pot. The Talmud teaches us that even though what we call hachazara, taking off and putting back on, is permissible, that's only in the words of the Talmud, al gaba, on top of it, but not litocha, not in it. And according to many authorities, that is a serious problem with respect to a crockpot, since you're placing it in the crockpot. In the case of the slow cooker, that problem does not exist because there's no in, there's just this on. And on would be permissible, again, with a blech or the equivalent. The equivalent of a blech and a crockpot might be a tinfoil, which could cover the slow cooker and enable you to take something off the fire, off it, and put it back, for example. Nachum, you and I know some people, we don't mention any names, who would want to raid the child on a Friday night. and take some off and put it back. So if it's a crockpot, in my opinion, it's a very serious issue. Ooh. Because you're putting it back into something, not on something. In a slow cooker, it's less of an issue. If it's a blech, one may, in fact, take it off, hold on to it, we'll get to that later,
right,
and then put it back on the tinfoil without that being a violation. But in terms of leaving the shawl there from before Shabbos, yes, you would likely have to have the shawl at least one half cooked before Shabbos in order for you to be able to do so, because generally speaking, crockpots are not blechable. They're just the typical crockpot is just exposed. And as we said before, if it's an exposed fire, the food has to be half-cooked before Shabbos. Typically, not your case where someone wakes up at the last minute, but typically someone who's preparing on Friday from earlier, the shawl does reach half-cooked before Shabbos.
Right, yeah. I was addressing the emergency challenge issue.
In the emergency case, if you want to use a crock pot, you'd have to make some kind of a blech. It's easy to make a blech if it's flat, slow cooker. If it is, encased, you'd have to take a lot of tinfoil and make some kind of a makeshift lech to cover the entire heating element, which is on the bottom, perhaps even on the sides, in order to enable you to do so, again, without respect to the issue of Hatzmana, which must be taken care of separately.
Right. Rabbi Mordechai Willig is with us. Not that this is your area of expertise, Rabbi Willig, so you may not be familiar with this at all, but I'm just so curious if you are. This may be more of an anthropological question, but do we have communities or groups of people that are known, therefore, because of this dispute between Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman as crockpot people or crockpot communities, and others that are known as slow cooker communities where they simply would not allow a crockpot to be used on Shabbos?
I'm sorry, but I cannot answer that question.
I'm just so curious if it's prevalent in some areas. Like if you go to areas where Rav Shlomo Zalman's psak was followed to the T, I guess you would never find the crockpot in that type of Shabbos
situation. Unless they're using those marbles.
Right. Oh, good point. Right. Right. Unless they're using the practical advice to make.
As long as they haven't lost their marbles, they'll be okay.
Then they'll be all right. You know, we talk about so many different regulations and categories when it comes to cooking. So one of the things that I think many people listening to this are familiar with is that the actual pot, the actual urn, I guess, and you can, you know, help me qualify whatever statements I'm making here, that would be considered a kli rishon, right? The ultimate first source of the hot item, correct?
Correct.
Kli sheni, I guess essentially a ladle would be the best example. Would you agree with that?
No,
that would not be the best example.
No, a ladle is not the best example because the ladle is inserted into the pot while it's on the fire.
Ah.
That causes a whole controversy.
Understood.
The best example of a kli sheni is to the contrary. You have a pot of food. Take the food out of the pot and put it into a plate or pour it into a cup. That's considered to be cliché.
So the soup bowl would be the cliché.
For sure. Because if it came from a ladle, it might be called a cliché-lishy, because the ladle's status is doubtful.
Right, understood. And then what would, in fact, a cliché-lishy or the third cli, the third vessel, be in any process?
That's an excellent question. Going back to Moshe Feinstein, he has expressed leniency with respect to cliché-lishy, because although it is found in the sources in the Shulchan Aruch, along the side, the Magen Avraham, Mishnah Berurah, to be strict with respect to kli sheni, there is some wiggle room with respect to kli shlishi. If other sources are not in agreement, and they maintain that sheni and shlishi are fundamentally the same. That's, I believe, how Rav Soloveitchik held, and others. You go back all the way to the time of the Rishonim, look in the Sefer Yireim of Rabbi Lezer Mimitz. He seems to also say that sheni and shlishi are fundamentally the same. So this is, again, another dispute. There's so many of them with respect to whether kli shlishi will solve the problems that kli sheni does not, or whether the shlishi and sheni are identical. Now, kli sheni ain't a mevashel. It says in the Talmud, kli sheni ain't a mevashel.
It can't cook.
So there should be no problem.
Right.
There are two reasons why there is a problem. This is discussed at length in part one of the book. One of them is, Tosis suggests, on Daf Lamed Tes, that it's merzik mevashel. It looks like cooking. That's reason number one, a rabbinical prohibition, presumably. And then there's a potential for even a Torah prohibition for something which is called kale habishal, things which cook readily or easily. And perhaps, although generally speaking, a cliché would not affect cooking, but for certain foods, perhaps it would. And this leads to all kinds of problems in real life, because the Magen Avraham seems to indicate that since we're not expert as to what is easily cooked and what is not, we should be strict on just about everything. That's a problem.
It is Shabbos, after all, right?
That's true.
So when we rely on a kli shlishi to allow us to do certain things, and I'm thinking, I guess, of the classic example of making tea on Shabbos, right? A glass of tea where one would take a cup of hot water, which at that point, I guess we could all agree, would be a kli shlishi, right?
And then pour into another cup and make it a kli shlishi.
Right, and pour into another cup. So according to those who look at that third cup as also a kli shlishi, it wouldn't help much.
That is correct. Rav Moshe Feinstein seems to be lenient in that respect, as I mentioned, but there are others who are not.
And, I always think that that it was automatic, I guess, because, you know, when you're familiar with something, you automatically think everyone does that. But as you're describing a kli shlishi and a kli shlishi to many, are exactly the same halachically. Are there other practical examples? The tea example, again, is one that I can relate to. Are there other practical examples that we need to know that would come up on a typical Shabbos in terms of a use of a kli sheni or a kli shlishi?
Well, there are many, many situations that people are putting things into a kli sheni or shlishi, and but I think tea is, you are correct. Tea is the most significant example because that is very, very common. There are other cases. I'll give another example. Someone has soup, hot soup.
Uh-huh.
So he wants to put salt in the soup. Luckily, salt is pre-cooked. So we have confirmed the principle we mentioned earlier of ein bishul acha bishul. Salt is a solid, and even though it becomes liquefied, most authorities say it's treated in its original form as a solid.
And then, and therefore, anyone who any item one wants to put in their soup, they better make sure it's pre-cooked or pre-baked.
And here's the problem. People like to put other spices in their soups.
And
other spices are not necessarily pre-cooked.
Right.
So therefore, you have a problem. So that's why if you hold kli shlishi is okay, then there is a way out, according to almost everybody, which is take the soup pot off the fire, put the ladle in the soup pot when it's not on the fire. According to almost everyone, Chazon Ish says so explicitly, this is called the kli sheni, the ladle. The soup bowl is in a kli shlishi, so you can put any, put your pepper or whatever you want into the soup, it's no problem. However, if you're worried about kli shlishi for certain items which may cook readily, such as granulated spices, then you have a problem even in a kli shlishi potentially. It's remarkable, in the time of the Talmud, one of the cases where it's explicit that you may use a kli sheni, something called tavlin, or spices or flavors. There are those who maintain, however, that they were using different kinds of flavors in those days. They weren't using granulated, they were using roots, and it was not from Kali Abishal as opposed to our granulated spices. There could be other distinctions. So there are many complexities over here.
Do we have any room to use the Oneg Shabbos reason, Rabbi Willing, that someone must have a certain spice in their soup in order to have the full Shabbos experience?
Well, you know, there is one way out of that.
And that is?
That is wait till it cools off.
Very good. Very good. And could it even stay warm a bit, stay at
a
certain temperature?
Yeah, there's another interesting, another thing which is discussed at length in part one of the book. There's a certain limit beneath which nothing cooks. That's called Yad So Lettuce Bo.
Right.
Something which is too hot to touch.
Right.
This, of course, is itself the subject of controversy. How hot is that? The estimates range from as low as 104 Fahrenheit to as high as 180. So you have a tremendous range of opinions in this area. And here, Moshe Feinstein himself said you should be strict on all levels. We should be strict down to 104, 110 on one side. On the other hand, if you want to invoke the principle of ein bishul acha bishul and be guaranteed that it's been previously cooked, you have to wait until it's reached yatzaletus for sure, which is 160, in one place he writes even 180. So there are, you know, there are complexities in terms of how you define yatzaletus, though.
Wow, unbelievable. Rabbi Mordechai Willig, he's the author of the book, The Laws of Cooking and Warming Food on Shabbat, a Magid Books release, which is an imprint of Koren Publications, with us via telephone as we explore some of the things that need to be discussed regarding cooking and warming food on Shabbos. You spoke about the blech, and I think everybody out in our audience knows what a blech is, or the majority of people at least. A metal plate that essentially sits on top of the fire and allows someone to warm something up on Shabbos. I guess that would be the most common use for the blech.
Right.
Are there common Shabbos mistakes with the blech? I mean, again, I tried to emphasize toward the beginning of our conversation how so many of us, unfortunately, are not familiar enough with Hilchos Shabbos when it comes to Bishul, when it comes to cooking food, especially those who don't spend enough time in the kitchen. But even those who do spend time in the kitchen, are there certain misconceptions or mistakes that are made with the blech that you'd like to see stop?
Okay, that's a good question. It's important for us to understand what the blech achieves. We mentioned before that there is a rabbinical layer, which is part two of the book, certain things which by Torah law would be permissible, but you run afoul of rabbinical prohibitions. For example, you have something which is dry and has been fully cooked. So we apply the principle of ein bishul acha bishul, take chicken or kugel. So once it's been cooked before Shabbos, There's no Torah prohibition that's going to be violated. However,
can't be recooked.
Yeah, right. It's been cooked already. You can't kill a dead dog. You can't cook a cooked food.
Right.
However, the rabbis have certain restrictions, which one of them is that you may not return food onto an uncovered fire.
Right.
However, if the fire is covered, that is called Ketuma in Talmudic parlance. It's covered. We assume that a blech is good, although Chazon Ish doesn't like it. It's not enough of a cover, but we assume it is a good cover. Then one may return food to the fire which is covered. However, Talmud teaches us that if one puts the food down on the ground or the equivalent, then even if the fire is covered, one may not return the food onto that fire.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most common mistake made with respect to a blech,
right.
That if you took the food off the fire and you put it on the floor, according to the Shulchan Aruch, one may not return that food onto even a covered fire. There is a minority view, which apparently was prevalent in certain parts of Europe, that as long as the food was on the fire when Shabbos came in, even if you took it off and put it on the ground, you may still return it to a covered fire. The Ramah quotes that view. It says, Tov l'hachma, one should try to avoid relying upon that. So those who do rely upon it, perhaps they ask their mothers, and their mothers have that custom going back to Europe,
right.
And we're not here to criticize anyone. But according to the standard halacha, which is what most accept nowadays, one should try to avoid that situation. So therefore, even if the fire is covered with a blech, it's only permissible if the food is not only just fully cooked, etc., but you also should have it in your hand, not let go, and you should have in mind to return it at the time that you removed it from the covered fire.
Right. And, you know, I'd like to point out that, especially for those who sometimes find that, laws of cooking on Shabbos are difficult, and obviously there's nothing that simple about it, but if I read what I read correctly, based on what was written in the book, there was a desire, there was an encouragement among the rabbis to have hot food on Shabbos. In other words, we should look at it in a positive manner, that because we could shut the whole thing down and say, you know what, you know, enjoy your cold food the entire Shabbos and make the best of it, so to speak. But there was a desire, even with all the rules and regulations, to have hot food even on Shabbos day, correct?
You're so correct, Nachum. Let me explain to you one of the reasons. Number one, as we said before, next Shabbos,
right.
We want to enjoy the Shabbos. But it's more than that. There was a group called the Karaim,
right,
who interpreted a verse in the Torah, not to mean, as it does, not to kindle a fire on Shabbos. They interpreted to mean not to have any fire on Shabbos.
Right.
They were unable to have hot food. And therefore, in order to make it clear that the Karaim's interpretation is incorrect, there's an insistence to have hot food on Shabbos. So much so that if you look in the Rishonim, in the third parak of Shabbos, when they discuss this matter, they say an individual who refuses to have any hot food on Shabbos whatsoever, we suspect them of being, in their words, a min, someone who is a heretic, who follows the interpretation of the Karaim. So you didn't realize how right you are. That's just a matter of Onik Shabbos. It's a matter of saying to everybody that we believe that, yes, the Torah does allow us to have a fire from before Shabbos and to thereby enjoy Onik Shabbos with hot food.
All right. We want to have the ultimate Shabbos meal. It should just be done kedasu kedin. Simple as that. Rabbi Mordechai Willig is with us, the laws of cooking and warming food on Shabbat. A lot of people do have non-Jewish people involved in their home life, somebody who's taking care of the kitchen or helping take care of the kitchen, people who take care of the kids, might be preparing food for kids or bottles for kids, as time goes by. I would guess this is a very important area for people to be familiar with in terms of a non-Jewish involvement in the cooking process on Shabbos.
Absolutely. As you probably can expect, this is not something which started now, but
right,
it existed in Europe. And the Ramah in Siman Reish Nun Gimel Sif Hei makes a blanket statement that whatever a Jew cannot do by himself, he should not do through a non-Jew either.
Right.
Now, there may be certain exceptions to that rule, which are too complex to go into right now, but I think that we should try our best to follow the rule of the Ramah, and whatever we don't do ourselves, we should not ask a non-Jew to do for us.
Could one of those exceptions be what's needed to be prepared for a baby, or it's not that simple to make?
A baby is sinner. For a baby, has a status of a chola.
Right.
With respect to a chola, there are many things that you can do. Perhaps you can even ask a non-Jew to actually cook,
right,
which is a Torah violation for the sake of anyone who is categorized as a chola. But I'm discussing a regular situation. And even for a baby, of course, you should try to do your best and prepare it before Shabbos. Only in an emergency where something went wrong, you'd be allowed to ask a non-Jew to help for a baby as well as for anyone who's categorized as a chola shein bo sakana.
Earlier we discussed what you described as dry food, which I think all of us understood, something that it is not under the category or doesn't fall to the category of a bishulach or bishul. It would be ein bishulach or bishul when it comes to dry food. And I think it's obvious to many that if you're dealing with soup or hot water, that is something that can be recooked, so to speak. What about the, I don't know, maybe we'd call it the hybrid, the meatballs in a really good thin sauce, or a turkey in a really nice gravy? Would they have a different status than simply a dry item?
You asked an excellent question, which is discussed in the book. We try our best whenever we are trying to reheat something to eliminate any possible liquids. We shake it off. We try to only to put the dry meatball or turkey on the fire to be reheated. There is an issue of congealed gravy, which is a double issue. Number one, it's an issue of cooking, because at the end of the day, it will be turned into a liquid. With respect to that, the poskim say we follow the original status, which is more solid, especially as explained in the book, if it's in a situation where it is edible even at room temperature, which is the case in the examples that we just gave.
Right.
There are other issues for Ashkenazim. It's something which is called nolad, which means if it started as a solid and it came into a liquid, it runs into a mukta problem or another problem of that type. So that's a separate discussion. But in any event, whenever we put something on a fire, we should try to make sure there's as much liquid as can be removed should be. It's impossible to remove every last drop. We have certain leniencies with respect to a tiny bit. There are other hybrids, which are things such as ketchup and the like, which are, half solid, half liquid. And that's discussed in the book as well. It's a major controversy how it should be treated. Many say it could be treated as a solid, and especially according to the criteria I mentioned before, because it can be easily consumed at room temperature.
And by the way, we should note also, not to make this even more complicated, but when one wants to, in fact, separate that gravy from the turkey, they should be careful. There may be other things they need to consider about how to do that, correct?
Bowrer, you mean.
Yeah.
From one malacha to another.
I guess that's for the next book, huh?
Oh.
But everyone should be careful and realize that there are people that can advise exactly what the proper way is to do it. What about food that was prepared in an improper fashion? We have described in this conversation, we have a few minutes to go here, we have described so many different instances, and obviously some of them, just according to the basic logic of our conversation, people would be able to conclude would be considered prepared in an improper fashion. Is there ever a case when we can use that food on Shabbos, even if it was prepared in what we would call either a bidyeved or maybe even a completely unallowable fashion?
Right. That's the last part of the book, and it's also complex, as you can well imagine,
Based
upon the sources in the Talmud and the analysis of the various commentators on the Shulchan Aruch. The short answer is, yes, there can be cases in which something was done improperly and still may be used, as you said, bidyeved after the fact.
Right.
It depends in part on whether the violation was intentional or unintentional. It depends in part on exactly what was the violation. Was it left there from before Shabbos or put there on Shabbos, put on a covered fire or an uncovered fire, depending if it was perhaps was done by a Jew or by a non-Jew. Those are some of the considerations which come into play.
Okay, a couple of more things, Rabbi Willig, and there are so many. I mean, I suggest to everybody, when you see the book, you'll see just how many topics are covered and how many different things there are to know. We should also mention, especially for those who are more familiar with the direct halachic sources, Rabbi Willig, you've included portions of Am Mordechai, which how would we put it? A more scholarly way of approaching these topics? Would that be an accurate way of putting it?
That's accurate. It's also in the Hebrew language,
right,
which is not accessible to everybody.
Right.
It's written in, you know, rabbinic Hebrew.
But we should mention that it's included
it's
here.
It's included, right. It's, there are some things which are omitted in the English language version simply for considerations of space,
right,
and or complexity. But perhaps more important than what I wrote, there are the inclusion of the source material from the Talmud and from the Shulchan Aruch, and from the various responsa, and from various modern svarim. That's also included, so it's somewhat self-contained, although, as we know, in any system of law, nothing is ever completely self-contained.
Did I?
There's always more wisdom to be gleaned from other sources.
No question. When I mentioned earlier about modern technology, we spoke about crock pots, warmers, microwaves. Did I miss anything from the 21st century that should be included in this conversation?
Absolutely. I was waiting for you to ask me about warming drawers, which is the newest grade.
Ah, right.
And that is also discussed in the book with some fascinating complexity. The problem with warming drawers is that it's not so easy to make a blech in some of them. Some of them, the adjustment is on top and the warming drawer is on the bottom. And since the whole essence of a blech, the purpose of it, is it should be recognizable, what we call a heker. So when you see it, you'll be reminded not to adjust the fire. It's of very little use if the adjustment is on top. It could be even, you know, at shoulder level. And the warming drawer is at knee level, and it's closed, and you adjust it on top, you won't even see whatever kind of so-called blech you're going to try to make in the drawer itself. So it's not going to be effective. And then the question is there a way to cover the knob or the panel where the adjustment would normally be made in a fashion which in and of itself would allow for the putting something in the warming drawer without concern that you will adjust it. Based on the analysis in the Sefer, in the book, something which is called toch betit. Talmud has a case where you plaster it over, and because of this fascinating concept, when something is plastered over and it requires a lot of work to undo the plaster before you get to the opportunity to adjust it, by that time you remember that it's Shabbos, you're not going to do it. And what is the equivalent of that in our modern-day situations is itself questionable. Just a piece of tape, we need many layers of tape. That is discussed in the book as well.
And finally, is there any... Often when people want to warm something up, the blech obviously is the, I guess, ideal example of warming something up on Shabbos. There are other heat sources around. There could be an oven that's been left on. If someone would simply place the item on top of that oven, it might heat up, or near the oven, it might heat up. There may be an urn that is, that's holding, very hot water the entire Shabbos. And if someone put something on top of that, it would heat it up. Can all, especially for dry items, can all those sources be considered essentially the same, that if you put something near or on top of something that would simply keep an item warm, it would be allowable on Shabbos?
Not necessarily. If the item can get to a point which is called Yad Soledesva, which is too hot to touch, you have a problem, although there are leniencies. Putting something on top of an urn qualifies for something which is known as Kedera al Gabe Kedera. I did it in the Shulchan Aruch, Reishon and Gimel Sifhei, which is permissible. And therefore, you could put some kugel or chicken on top of the urn, and it gets as hot as it can get. We should also mention the possibility of what we call today a hot plate or hot tray.
Right.
If it's not adjustable, and if it's not used for cooking, then it should be permissible on logical grounds. We mentioned earlier two reasons why the rabbis prohibited returning things onto fires especially if they were put down before. One is because you made a justifier that will not apply on a non-adjustable hot plate. And the second is because it looks like cooking, which should also not apply to such a device which is never used for cooking. That's something that's featured prominently in the book as well.
Rabbi Willig, what comforting words can you give to people who find Hilchos Shabbos and specifically Hilchos Bishul so difficult to the point where they may panic in terms of what they are or are not doing on Shabbos?
My words of comfort are very simple. Don't panic. Just study the laws. And if you study them, they're not that complex. Then one can get a general understanding from many, many sources. My book is certainly they're not the first or the last, but there are many wonderful, wonderful sources that could be used. And there's no need to panic. Just go slowly and realize what you should do. And if you really get stuck, call your mother.
I'm so flattered that you returned back to my initial piece of advice. Rabbi Willig, I take this opportunity not only to thank you, but to continue to wish you and your entire family amazing success and all the mazel tovs for the recent simchas you've had and for the release of Lev Avos, which so many people, even outside the Willig family, are enjoying in terms of great Jewish music. And I really thank you so much for being part of this show and for joining me here today.
Nachum, thank you very much.
Rabbi Mordechai Willig here on the Nachum Siegel Network. The book is entitled The Laws of Cooking and Warming Food on Shabbat. The Michael Scharf Publication Trust of Yeshiva University Press and REITs, Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, plus the REITs Halacha series, which is edited by Rabbi Daniel Z. Feldman. It's a Magid Books imprint, or I should say a Magid Books release, which is an imprint of Koren Publications. You can go to korenpub.com. For more information, I thank Rabbi Mordechai Willig for joining me and giving us so much time here to examine to whatever degree we were able to. Again, we recommend to everybody to get the book and to explore more about the details of cooking on Shabbos, but I thank him for the time he gave us this morning to explore some of the issues. I remind everybody that Buy the Book is in its first run at 10 o'clock Eastern Time every Tuesday morning here at the Nachum Siegel Network. Rabbi Mordechai Willig is the Rabbi Dr. Saul Roth, Professor of Talmud and Contemporary Halacha at Yeshiva University's Mazer Yeshiva Program, the Rosh Kolel of the Bella and Harry Wexner Kolel Elyon, and the Skan Rosh Kolel of the Kolel Lahara, Yadin Yadin at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, an affiliate of Yeshiva University. He's also the Deputy Av Beis Din of the Beth Din of America, and the author of its prenuptial agreement. Rabbi Willig has served as spiritual leader of the Young Israel of Riverdale in the Bronx since 1974, author of Am Mordechai, a series of Sfarim on the Talmud, published many articles in Torah journals, and this one, the brand new Laws of Cooking and Warming Food on Shabbat, is a comprehensive presentation of Hilchos Bishul and the reasoning behind the laws. It's a wide-ranging volume. Rabbi Willig presents and analyzes the opinions of the most respected voices in halachic discourse. He traces the law from the biblical prohibition to rabbinic legislation, from medieval authorities to decisors of our time, exploring new issues involving present-day applications and the impact of modern technology. The Laws of Cooking and Warming Food on Shabbat encompasses the range of complexities and challenges of this central area of Jewish law. It is a crucial resource for laymen, students, and scholars alike. The volume is published in cooperation with Yeshiva University Press with supplementary notes and rulings by Rabbi Herschel Schechter. It is highly recommended, and it comes from our friends at Magid Books, an imprint of Koren Publications. Bring the Beit HaMikdash, I should say, to life by studying Maseches Yoma in color with our friends from Koren. Order a subscription to the print edition of the Koren Talmud Bavli. Get a free digital edition. The digital edition is compatible on all mobile devices, including iPod, tablet, iPad, and more. The package has a $60 value for each volume. It's perfect for your commute to work. Go to korenpub.com. Use the promo code JM in the AM at checkout, and you'll be able to take advantage of that amazing offer. And it is an amazing offer, and one that every single week we continue to recommend. I thank all of you for tuning in to this edition, the first run edition, Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, and the replay editions through the week of Buy the Book here at the Nachum Siegel Network. A big thank you to Koren Publications, who continue to bring us amazing guests and incredible insight every single week from some of the top scholars in our community worldwide. And I thank them for that. You are listening to the Nachum Siegel Network.